are listening to Based in Fact, a true crime podcast. Join host Lisa O'Brien and Kyle Evans as they examine America's most infamous true crime cases as they were established in our courts and the basis for the decisions of the appeals courts, not the court of public opinion. Here's Lisa and Kyle.
Welcome back for season 3 of Based in Fact, a true crime podcast. We're your hosts, Lisa O'Brien and Kyle Evans, and this is episode 5, State of New Jersey versus Melanie McGuire. Between May 5th and May 16th, 2004, 3 suitcases containing dismembered human remains washed up near the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel in Virginia. The remains inside those cases belonged to Bill McGuire, a New Jersey computer analyst and Navy veteran. In 2007, his wife Melanie was convicted of first-degree murder, possession of a weapon for an unlawful purpose, desecration of human remains, and perjury. In July 2007, she was sentenced to life in prison plus 5 years, making her ineligible for parole until 2073. We'll talk about Bill's disappearance, the McGuire's troubled marriage, and the evidence against McGuire, along with the course of her direct appeal and post-conviction claims since her 2007 conviction. And good afternoon. Welcome back, Kyle. We missed you.
I know. Missed you. Good afternoon. It's such a beautiful, it's great now that spring is coming.
Yes, it is here. And I think summer is really what it's going to be.
Yeah, exactly.
We have our firm crawfish boil scheduled for next Saturday, and the weather is supposed to be beautiful but hot and humid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think it's gonna be another hot one.
Yes, it is definitely. So, all right, well, let's get started on Melanie McGuire. And of course, we start with the victim, William Theodore Bill McGuire. Now, in some locations, some sources, he's listed as a junior, but technically he's not a junior. His name was William Theodore McGuire. His father's name was William Christopher McGuire. And those are different names. Usually a junior is an identical.
Yeah, it's funny. It's exactly like me and my dad. My dad and I have the same first name, but different middle names.
Mm-hmm. So he was born September 21st, 1964 in Bronx County, New York. So he was 1 week younger than I am, which is kind of sad. Again, his father was William Christopher McGuire, who was born in 1931 and passed away in 1996. Oh, my connection just became unstable. Oh, joy, joy, joy.
Yeah, you cut out for just a quick second. I wasn't sure if it was me or you, but yeah, you cut out for just a quick second.
I got the little unstable connection message. He passed away in 1996. His mother was Ruth Theodora Sell McGuire. She was born in 1935 and passed away in 2003. So this would have been right before, a year before Bill was murdered. He had a sister, Cynthia. He may have had other siblings. She's the only person I found. For sure, this case is after the internet really started taking off, but not as much information as available as you would expect, in spite of that. He was a graduate of Vernon Township High School in Glenwood, New Jersey. He graduated in 1982. He also attended Rutgers University from 1991 to 1994, where he studied pharmacology. He was a United States Navy veteran. He was a data systems technician, petty officer third class, so he had the rank of DS3. He also was a programmer systems analyst for the New Jersey Institute of Technology, and he was an adjunct professor there as well. And he worked with Essex Regional Health Commission as presumably a programmer systems analyst. May have been health information systems and things like that. He was married first to Marcy Palk in 1986. They divorced in 1994. I don't think there were any children from that union. And then he married Melanie Lynn Slate in 1999. And their marriage ended when she killed him in 2004. They had two sons who are pretty much completely unnamed in the sources. There is a book by John Glatt called To Have and To Kill, which is actually an excellent book. I would highly recommend it about this case. And the boys may have been named in that source. I'm not sure. Bill's injury, COD, was gunshot wounds to the chest and head. And then, of course, his body was dismembered, although that was done after he had died. Then we have our perpetrator is Melanie Lynn Slate McGuire. She was born October 8th, 1972 in Ridgewood, New Jersey. Her mother is Linda Caparero now. I don't know what her name was at the time Melanie was born, whether she was Linda Slate or something else. And then Melanie's stepfather is Michael Caparero. Again, there's not a lot of information, but it sounds kind of like when Melanie was very young, her mother married Caparero. And so Caparero served kind of as a father for her. I don't know whether she has any siblings. I've never seen any siblings associated with the case or in any of the articles, but she may have a brother or sister out there who is supporting her from the wings. She was a graduate of Middletown High School South. She also earned degrees in math and psychology in 1994 from Rutgers University, and she earned a nursing diploma in 1997 from the Charles E. Gregory School of Nursing in New Jersey. That is a new name, but I didn't bother to put it down. She married William Theodore Bill McGuire in 1999, and that marriage ended when she murdered him. She had two sons. Based on my lay opinion, she is manipulative. I believe she has a borderline personality as well, and she is dishonest. And we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Yeah, that's just a few of her
a few of her problems. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I hate to make light of it, but yeah, I think sounds like exactly what my wife has threatened to do to me a few times. So.
Well, I hope that if she were to do it, she would make as many mistakes as Melanie McGuire. Yeah.
She may be doing an episode about me someday.
All right. So some other crimes that she's committed along the way are forgery, perjury, making false statements to police. She bought a gun using an, I would say, illegitimate identification. She lived in New Jersey, worked in New Jersey, but she had a Pennsylvania driver's license with an aunt's Pennsylvania address on it. This was probably done to perhaps try to avoid taxes in New Jersey or income taxes in New Jersey or some form of scam. While if you watch interviews, you hear all these claims from McGuire about scams and schemes from Bill, and that, you know, she just went along with because, but frankly, I think she was the scammer and schemer.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe he was one to take advantage when he could, but she was no innocent little lamb. And she was probably right there with him, scamming and scheming. Although, as I understand it, he had a New Jersey driver's license, so I don't have confirmation of that, but and her victim was William Theodore McGuire, Bill McGuire. This crime occurred on April 28th, 2004, or perhaps April 29th, 2004. The victim was William Bill McGuire. It occurred at 2902 Plaza Drive in Woodbridge, New Jersey. That is in Middlesex County. Melanie Slate and Bill McGuire met while the two worked as servers at a New Jersey restaurant. They were alike in many ways and seemed made for each other. Both were quick-witted, sarcastic, and pranksters. Melanie was pursuing degrees in math and psychology at Rutgers University, and Bill was a recently discharged Navy veteran pursuing a degree in pharmacology at Rutgers. It's unclear whether Bill's first marriage to Marcy Paul had ended at the time he and Melanie began their relationship. Bill and Melanie dated for several years, and in 1998, Bill introduced Melanie to his closest friends. In 1999, they were married. It was Bill's second marriage and Melanie's first. Melanie worked as a nurse at a New Jersey fertility clinic, and Bill was a programmer, systems analyst, and adjunct professor at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. Their first child, a son, was born around 2000. In spite of marital issues that had surfaced in 2001, Melanie became pregnant with their second child, who was born in 2002. Prior to going out on maternity leave, Melanie had engaged in an at-work flirtation with Dr. Bradley Miller, one of the doctors she worked with at the clinic. That flirtation became a full extramarital affair with Miller when she returned to the clinic after her maternity leave. The McGuire's relationship had seemed perfect to their friends and family. They were known to joke and tease one another, and no one ever observed signs of strife, anger, or abuse in their relationship. One source of disagreement was Bill's desire to move to Virginia Beach, Virginia, and Melanie's desire to remain in New Jersey. In early 2004, the McGuires found their dream home in Warren County, New Jersey, and they began saving for the down payment and put in an offer of $500,000 for the property. They made the down payment and qualified for a mortgage, and the closing was scheduled for 4/28/2004. In spite of Melanie's later claims that she didn't like the house and didn't want it, the closing went forward and they signed the papers on the afternoon of April 28th. After the closing, Bill called the gas company to transfer service and spoke to two friends. His dream had been to own his own home by the age of 40, and he'd made that dream a reality. He was happy and looking forward to this new chapter in his life. Bill's last call was at 6:10 p.m. The seller called him later that evening, and he didn't return the call, which was unusual for Bill, who had a reputation for constant device usage. Melanie's last call that night was to Miller. She told him that the closing had gone forward as planned, and Bill had some wine and was asleep on the couch. She also told Miller that she was going to work it all out that night. Melanie claims that in the early morning hours, Bill woke up and they got into a heated argument. She claims she told him she'd settled on the house and that Bill countered that he wanted a house in Virginia Beach, but she wouldn't go. Melanie claims that Bill saw a dryer sheet in the laundry basket and that he shoved it into her throat and slapped her in the face. When Melanie noticed their two-year-old son watching, she claims she grabbed the child and locked herself and the child in the bathroom. She claimed Bill berated her for being a bad mother, for endangering their children with dryer sheets, and lazy for using them at all. On April 29, 2004, Melanie took out an order of protection. At the hearing, she told the court that about the early morning events and claimed that while she was in the bathroom, she heard Bill rummaging around, presumably packing his belongings. She claimed he continued berating her and that his parting words were that she could tell her sons that she was the reason they didn't have a father. Finally, she swore to the court that she didn't know where Bill was. Melanie didn't tell the court about her April 26, 2004 trip to a gun shop in Easton, Pennsylvania, where, using a Pennsylvania driver's license with her aunt's Pennsylvania address on it, she purchased a Taurus, 38 caliber special model 85 B2 revolver. She also didn't tell the court that she'd filled a forged prescription for chlorhydrate, which is a sedative, at a Walgreens near her son's preschool on April 28, 2004. On April 30th, 2004, in spite of the order of protection and her professed fear of Bill, Melanie traveled to Atlantic City, where she'd left Bill's 2002 Nissan Maxima outside the Flamingo Hotel. The grainy surveillance video showed Bill's car being parked in the lot and the driver of that car being picked up by a vehicle similar to Melanie's Nissan Pathfinder. Melanie made a second trip to Atlantic City on 5-1-2004 or 5-2-2004, in which she returned to Bill's car to place a call from his cell phone to the Woodbridge townhouse. Melanie and her stepfather later disputed two charges for Melanie's EasyPass toll tag for this trip and tried to force their removal from the records. On May 5th, 2004, a 24-inch carry-on Kenneth Cole green and black suitcase was found floating near the Chesapeake Bay Lisa? Bridge. Yes. Hello? Oh. Kyle?
Hey, Lisa, are you back?
Yeah, I'm back. How far back? What was I in the middle of saying? This is going to get annoying.
Yeah, it was like 15 seconds. It wasn't very long.
Okay. All right. So I'll start with, I'm going to go back and take two. On May 5th, 2004, a 24-inch carry-on Kenneth Cole green and black suitcase was found floating near the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel's fourth artificial island. The suitcase contained human legs wrapped in garbage bags. At that time, Virginia authorities launched a murder investigation for a John Doe victim. On April 8, 2004, Bill's Nissan Maxima, where his cell phone was found, was towed from the Flamingo Hotel parking lot. On May 11th, a second green and black Kenneth Cole suitcase, this time a 30-inch case containing a male torso, washed up on the beach at the Fisherman Island National Wildlife Refuge. The suitcase was found by a grad student cleaning up litter on the beach. The victim's head was wrapped in a medical practice towel. On May 16, 2004, the third and final pieces of the victim's body, his midsection, was found floating near the bridge's second artificial island. This piece was in a 26-inch green and black Kenneth Cole suitcase, identical to the prior cases. Bill McGuire had a prior felony conviction and his fingerprints were in the system, but didn't lead to his identification, perhaps due to decomposition.
What was his felony conviction for, do you know?
I believe it was a driving conviction back in the mid-90s, and I believe it's when he and Melanie were dating. It sounds like they were on the phone while he was driving home. They were probably arguing and he was driving too fast. I'm not entirely sure.
It's crazy how much they seem to argue and everybody thought they had a perfect marriage. It's really strange how they were to kind of keep it.
The people that observed it felt that they both enjoyed the drama.
Yeah, there's a lot of people like that.
Yeah.
They're addicted to the fighting and the hysterics and the drama.
Right. So, Virginia authorities released a facial recognition sketch, and on May 21st, 2004, Bill's friends who lived in Virginia Beach contacted police. They were able to positively identify the victim as their friend, Bill McGuire. When questioned by Virginia police, Melanie initially denied owning matching luggage. The following day, she, quote, remembered, unquote, a set they owned and identified a picture of a suitcase as matching their set. In addition to giving all of Bill's clothes and belongings to a cousin, Melanie didn't report Bill missing during this time, even though she'd been contacted by friends who were concerned that they hadn't heard from him. On May 25th, 2004, she filed for divorce. Bill's car was found at the tow lot in Atlantic City, and it was examined. Inside, forensic investigators found human connective tissue and a bottle of chloral hydrate and a syringe. The McGuire's former townhouse was searched, although no evidence of a murder dismemberment could be found. Bill's wallet was also found in a storage unit leased by Melanie after Bill's, quote, disappearance, unquote. While his driver's license and credit cards were not in the wallet, there were business cards in the wallet, which proved he was using it in April 2004. On September 15, 2004, having found no evidence that Bill was murdered in Virginia, the case was transferred to New Jersey authorities. During the early investigation and later efforts, numerous pieces of circumstantial evidence implicating Melanie, including but not limited to, were found. The April 26th gun purchase of gun and ammunition in Pennsylvania using a Pennsylvania license. New Jersey has actually very strict gun laws, and that's why she went to Pennsylvania. Bill's wallet being found in the storage unit leased after April 28, 2004, the connective tissue in the driver's side floorboard of the Maxima, the forged chloral hydrate prescription picked up on the morning of April 28, 2004, her affair with Bradley Miller, the attempt by Melanie and her stepfather to remove charges from her EasyPass records, the towel found around Bill's head, which was linked to Melanie's clinic, plastic bags found wrapping Bill's body parts were similar to bags in the McGuire household and those used to dispose of Bill's clothes and belongings, the three matching Kenneth Cole suitcases, which were missing from the McGuire set, hair stubble recovered from some of the tape on the trash bags, which had Melanie's DNA. There was a 10-inch hair from one of the suitcases with DNA that didn't exclude Melanie, which suggests it was probably mitochondrial. And then recordings that Melanie made or that were made by two of Melanie's friends, or rather her friend James and Dr. Miller, in which she talked about the gun, buying the gun. She told a story about buying the gun because Bill wanted a gun and he couldn't buy one. So, of course, she had to do it for him, but that's a felony. And in fact, I think it would be a felony on her, not on him.
Yeah, it would definitely be on her, right? Because she's the one buying it. Yeah, I mean, so it wouldn't be. I mean,
if he was caught,
you can ask somebody to commit a crime, but if they do it, it's on them. It's not on the person that asks.
Exactly. Now, this was a very long investigation. It was not a rush to judgment, although, yes, it's true. Melanie was pretty much the only person they looked at, but that's because she's the only person that was in the apartment with him when he was last heard from. So, you know, she was his wife. That's, you're like prime suspect number one, and all this circumstantial evidence does not look good for you, honey. So Melanie was arrested on June 2nd, 2005. The investigation was a joint effort among the Division of Criminal Justice, the New Jersey State Police, the Middlesex County Prosecutor's Office, and the Woodbridge Police Department, given Melanie's penchant for crossing state and county borders. The New Jersey State Police, I think, probably were the ones to kind of spearhead the investigation. And so she was arrested for first-degree murder on June 2nd, 2005. She was able to post bail. Her bail was $750,000, so she was able to post $75,000. Something tells me Mr. Caporaro is quite wealthy. And they were quite wealthy. I mean, she was a nurse. He was a computer programmer, analyst, adjunct professor, and worked for the health system. So, I mean, they were making a lot of money, each of them. So, anyway, so they were able to post bail, probably with the help of her parents. On August 11th, 2005, a letter was sent to the Trentonian newspaper It was an anonymous letter purportedly typed by someone with a criminal inclination who was concerned about defendant's children being left without their mother. The writer claimed to have killed Billy Mack because he had become unreliable and greedy. To prove that the letter was not a hoax, the writer accurately recited three evidential facts about the murder and the cutting of the body that had not been reported in the news. On October 9, 2005, a second letter was sent to the New Jersey Attorney General's office or received by them. It was addressed to Dear Madam Assistant Attorney General, purportedly from an anonymous co-worker of Cindy Ligosh, Bill's sister, at the Weikert Realty Office in Franklin Lakes. The writer enclosed several items that were allegedly found in the trash at her office, including a wedding ring and bracelet believed to belong to Bill, an empty Ultramax ammunition box, a key to Bill's Nissan Maxima, a key to the lockbox found in the storage facility, rubber gloves, prescription medications, and marijuana wrapped in tinfoil. The package also contained allegedly discarded sheets of notepaper with writing that the anonymous sender identified as Ligosh's handwriting. The handwritten note said, set her up. One, deny that we know about firearm or that he made her get one. Two, deny that he used to move her car when they fought sometimes. Three, call prosecutors, read mafia allegations to implicate her family. DYFS adoption yields stipend for adoption through division. Four, secondary beneficiary on his state life insurance. Five, have kids say they saw her do it or dispose of the body. Final stages, bring bullets if no need to plant at her dad's. Indictment, termination of her parental rights, public statement against prosecution if no indictment of her family, speak to publisher, story rights, estate for boys, taunt her with not seeing kids, and we are their parents. The return address on the Federal Express package was Franklin Road, not Franklin. Wait, was wrong. It was Franklin Road, and it should have been something else, which I cut out by mistake. And it had the wrong telephone number listed on the letterhead. Also, the Weikert logo was a forgery. Finally, the office did not use Federal Express at that time. Shipping charges for the Federal Express package were paid with a $50 American Express gift card, which was purchased at 3:48 p.m. on October 9, 2005, at a Rite Aid pharmacy in Passaic. Surveillance film from a bank near that pharmacy showed that at 3:42 p.m. on that date, a woman walked from the parking lot into the Rite Aid pharmacy. Now, apparently, Melanie, nurse that she is, was able to obtain four prescription Schedule II medications, which I presume are the ones that were included in the FedEx package. They were Adderall XR, Ambien, Alprazolam, and Temazepam. So she's trying to implicate Bill in using drugs. And they can't quote.
Yeah, that's a weird mix of stuff.
Yeah. They can't quote. Uppers and downers. But some of the stuff that's in there, only she had access to.
Right.
You know, like the key to the lockbox that was in her storage unit. She was indicted on October 11th, 2005. For murder, first degree, possession of a weapon for an unlawful purpose, second degree, desecrating human remains, second degree, and perjury, third degree. And that's based on her statements at the protective order hearing. Her bail was set at $2.1 million. Was probably up from $750 to $2.1. She was able to make bail, so she was free pending trial. On October 26, 2006, she was indicted for additional charges, which included two counts of hindering prosecution third degree for the two letters, tampering with or fabricating physical evidence fourth degree, which is probably from the items that were enclosed in the FedEx envelope, False reports to law enforcement authorities, which probably dealt with trying to implicate Cindy Ligosh. And then possession of a controlled substance for the third degree for the Adderall, Ambien, Alprazolam, and Temazepam. Her bail was an additional $10,000 bail was set, and she again paid it and was able to stay free pending trial. Pre-trial, the case went to Middlesex Superior Court, New Brunswick, New Jersey. Honorable Frederick P. DeVisa. The county case number was 05001293. McGuire retained private counsel, Joseph Tacopina, who was an attorney from New York, who was quite famous and quite fond of the cameras and being on TV.
Yeah, she seems to have like unlimited resources.
Yeah. And then an attorney named Stephen Tarano, who was a New Jersey attorney. So, you know, she had local counsel and a New York attorney. And then an attorney named Mark Ward. He probably played a small role. He was listed on one of the appellate appeal opinions or on the docket. So I included him. And then the state of New Jersey was represented primarily by Patricia Prisocio, who was with the Attorney General's office, and then also attorneys from the Middlesex County Prosecutor's Office, whose names don't appear that I can find. And so if you're listening and you participated, please drop me a line and I will give you the just credit that you deserve.
Poor prosecutors never get the credit. It's always the defense guys in front of the camera.
Yeah. So on October 26th, an order of venue for the 2006 indictment was entered, designating Middlesex as the county for trial rather than, I guess it would have been, I don't know what county Passaic would have been in. And then a verified petition to seal, seeking the, that the indictment be sealed and the order of venue be sealed until their next court appearance. An order sealing the indictment and order of venue was entered on, all this was done October 26th, sealing them until the 30th of October, or when defendant is served with the indictment. On January 22nd, 2007, the court issued an opinion granting the state's motion to consolidate and join the indictments for trial on January 24th, an order for that was entered. And then on the 31st of January, the court issued an opinion that qualified Thomas Lesniak as an expert and permitted him to testify that the plastic garbage bags he examined were produced by the same tool, i.e. dye and cutters, and an order memorializing that opinion was entered on February 28th, 2007. The case went to trial. Counsel again was Patty Prisocio and Tacopina, Tarano, and Ward. The guilt innocence phase went from March 5th, 2007 to April 20th, 2007. That's my rough estimation. And then
that's pretty quick, right? For a murder trial?
That's actually pretty long. I mean, that's 4, 6 weeks, 7 weeks.
It just seemed like it was pretty quick.
March 5th to April 5th.
About like...
And then March 5th to April 5th, and then April 5th to April 20th. That's another 15 days. So, yeah, that's 7 weeks. Close to 7 weeks. No, because I mean, quick would be anything less than 10 days.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's true. I used to, back in the day when I was a newspaper reporter, I would cover some murder trials and they were like less than a week. So I guess that's fair.
Yeah.
We're all used to the, because what was the OJ trial? Like, felt like it was years.
It was horrible. And just so people know, you can watch this trial from start to finish, or at least from start to verdict, on Court TV and courttv.com. And it is helpfully called the New Jersey Suitcase Murder. So just anybody who's interested in watching a trial, either really closely watching it or just having it on for background, Court TV has a lot of trials and they're very interesting.
Yeah, that's, I didn't realize they had a whole archive. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not trying to make light of it, but it's kind of like Netflix, but it's like you can just go watch trials. I had no idea they had all those, all the old trials in the backlog.
Yeah.
For the archives, I guess.
And on April 20th, counts 4, 5, and 6 of the 2006 indictment, which were, let me see if I can tell you what ones those were. Okay. Count 4 was the false report. Count 5 was the possession of Adderall. Count 6 was the possession of Ambien. And count 8 was the possession of Temazepam. The state moved to dismiss those and the court dismissed them on the state's motion, I guess, because the state did not meet their burden of proof at trial to present, to put those before the jury. So those were dismissed. On the jury deliberated for 3 days. And on April 23rd, 2007, Melanie, and I'm saying Melanie, I know a lot of times I call the perpetrator by their last name, but in this case, because Bill's last name is McGuire too, I don't want to risk sounding like I'm criticizing Kim when I'm actually taking the piss out of her. So I'll call her Melanie. And, you know, beady-eyed little Melanie. The jury found her guilty on counts 1 through 4 of the 2005 indictment and not guilty on counts 1 through 3 and 7 of the 2006 indictment. So they felt that the proof presented of the letters, which was actually a former guest of Clear and Convincing, James Fitzgerald, the linguistic profiler, who used linguistic profiling to catch the Unabomber. He testified at this trial regarding the letters received by the Trentonian and the Attorney General's office, the one implicating Cindy Lygosh. He testified at this trial, but you know that there just wasn't sufficient proof for the jury that she had done these things, even though, you know, they found her. They acquitted her, which is not the same as saying she's innocent. They just found there wasn't proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I think there's sufficient proof to infer for those of us outside the jury box. On May 14, 2007, McGuire's attorneys filed a motion for new trial, alleging that jurors were basically influenced by Court TV coverage, were posting on the Court TV message boards, and that they had improper contact with a dismissed juror. There was a spate of weather in New Jersey, heavy rains. A juror's house was flooded, and so she was released from the jury because of that.
Oh my gosh.
So the jury had to restart deliberations, and apparently that juror left a note on another juror's car, just kind of wishing them the best of luck. And you know, it was a very innocuous letter when you read the entire thing. I may post the gist of it in the comments when I post the episode on Facebook. It was a very innocuous letter. But from that, the attorneys drew a lot of conclusions that were unsupported by the evidence or the testimony statements of the actual jurors. So there was a hearing. The jurors were questioned. And on June 18, 2007, the judge denied the motion for new trial. Now, at that hearing, Melanie's defense attorneys also claimed that they had new evidence and a new witness that exonerated her. On June 27, 2007, they filed another motion for new trial under seal, alleging that a new witness who worked as a bookkeeper for a loan shark in the Philadelphia, South Jersey area came forward after McGuire's conviction on April 23, 2007. The witness claimed to have been present when Bill talked to a loan shark to borrow $90,000. The loan shark told the witness to put him down in the books for $90,000. That's pretty much all the media articles say, and the motion was filed under seal, withdrawn, so it no longer exists. Oh, spoiler alert. On July 18, 2007, the defense withdrew that motion for new trial. Christopher Thieme, I don't know how to pronounce his last name right, T-H-I-E-M-E, if you want to look him up, a New Jersey inmate who claimed Bill was killed over a debt to a loan shark, was exposed as a fraud by prosecutors. Thieme contacted police after his initial interview and recanted his story. He also accused Stephen Toronto of asking him to testify falsely with a promise that McGuire's family would pay for his help. It was evident that Thieme never worked for organized crime and fabricated his account after learning about McGuire's conviction. Due to his lack of credibility, McGuire's counsel withdrew their motion for new trial. On July 19, 2007, McGuire was sentenced. Melanie was sentenced to life subject to no early release act. So she must serve 63 years and 9 months before she's eligible for parole. 10 years for desecrating a corpse concurrent to that sentence. So she's pretty much finished.
So
that
she's
one.
Never going to get out.
And then 5 years for the perjury consecutive. And she must serve 2.5 years of that before she's eligible for parole.
So, never getting out.
She's eligible for parole in 2073. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, how old will she be? Good, she'll be.
She'll be 101.
100. Yeah, it's like 101. Yeah.
Or she'll be 100, going on 101 in October.
Right.
Her direct appeal was decided by the Superior Court of New Jersey Appellate Division. And that was under docket number A-6576-06, T as in Tom, 4. Her attorneys were Jamie S. Kilberg and Stephen Toronto. The attorneys for the state were Daniel I. Bornstein, a deputy attorney general, and Paula Dow, attorney general. McGuire claimed she filed her notice of appeal on August 22nd, 2007, and the issues she raised, which I'm including in the notice of appeal, even though they weren't actually enumerated in that document, were jury taint deprived Miss McGuire of a fair trial. The jurors were repeatedly exposed to highly inflammatory media accounts. The trial court did not voir dire the jurors properly. The trial court failed to investigate evidence that jurors may have been posting to internet message boards during deliberations, and the trial court applied the wrong standard and burden of proof. 2, prosecutorial misconduct requires reversal and remand. The state's reliance on the absence of evidence it successfully excluded from the case requires reversal, which was not raised below. And other prosecutorial misconduct contributed to a fundamentally unfair trial. Portions of that were not raised below. The trial court committed numerous evidentiary errors requiring reversal. The trial court erred in admitting expert testimony regarding garbage bags. The trial court erroneously excluded relevant, admissible, and exculpatory evidence supporting the defense. And the majority of that was actually Bill's first wife's testimony that he abused her and gambled when they were married. And their marriage ended because of that abuse and gambling. But Melanie could have testified and talked about the abuse and gambling, but she made the choice not to testify.
Or she could have just divorced him.
Yes, she very well could have. But she was worried about what she had expressed to coworker who had just gone through a nasty divorce, what it would cost her to divorce him. And I got the impression from a lot of people that, again, people didn't see any of this stuff.
Yeah, it was all,
you know, and I think because of the fact that I believe she is a manipulative person, I think that these are stories all created out of whole cloth. I find the whole story about what happened on the night of April, the early morning hours of April 29th, to be melodramatic, and they don't have the ring of truth. I mean, and when you see her tell the story, every interview from early before her trial to recent interviews on 2020, it's the same words in the same order. Right. You know, oh, and he saw a dryer stick sticking out of the thing, and he hated those. And he used to say I was lazy for not standing there and putting the fabric softener in. You know, even though, honey, dryer sheets have been around since I was a teenager and you were in elementary school. And they actually are the norm.
Right.
You know. I mean, and they're better for your washer and dryer. They're better for your washer because fabric softener tends to gum up the works of a washing machine. So, but you know, I guess Bill didn't know that.
Right.
I say that sarcastically. So anyway, and the evidence that they claim the state, I'm not sure what the evidence, I don't remember what the evidence was that they had successfully excluded. But anyway, reversal is required. Okay, so then Ms. McGuire is entitled to resentencing. The trial court erred by invoking post-murder conduct to aggravate the murder charge, which was not raised below, and the court erroneously refused to consider a mitigating factor. On July 13, 2009, an order was entered denying McGuire's motion to supplement the record on direct appeal or for a limited remand, which I believe was to provide more information about the allegations on jury misconduct. And then oral argument was held October 27, 2010. James Kilberg argued for McGuire. Daniel Bornstein argued for the state. The decision was rendered on March 26, 2011, after a jury trial in the Superior Court of New Jersey Law Division, Middlesex County. Defendant was convicted and given a life sentence on charges, including murdering her husband and desecrating his body. Defendant appealed. The victim's body had been cut in pieces, wrapped in garbage bags, and packed in suitcases. Defendant challenged the admissibility of expert testimony, including tool mark analysis that matched garbage bags in which sections of the victim's body were found with ones used by defendant in her apartment. The High Court held that a tool mark expert's opinion was properly admitted under Rule of Evidence 702, as his testimony established the general acceptance of his discipline in the forensic evidence community. The trial court properly excluded testimony about a statement the victim allegedly made several months before his death, proffered by the defense under the hearsay exceptions for state of mind, and statements against penal interest, which was the allegation that he wanted Melanie to buy a gun for him. Under New Jersey Rule of Evidence 803C3 and 803C25. As to alleged prosecutorial misconduct, in summation, in which the prosecutor commented about the excluded defense evidence and also speculated about some facts without adequate support in the circumstantial evidence, the improper remarks did not deprive defendant of a fair trial. The record showed that jurors' knowledge of an internet court TV message board and of blogs discussing the jurors did not affect their verdict. The verdict and sentence were affirmed. Okay. So in on June 17, 2011, McGuire's attorney sent a letter in lieu of formal petition for certification to the New Jersey Supreme Court. It was assigned docket number 67,976. And she basically was presenting points 1 through 4 that were presented to the Superior Court to be reviewed by the Supreme Court. A letter in lieu of formal brief in opposition was sent on June 30th, 2011, which opposed certification of the case by the Supreme Court. On September 22nd, 2011, an opinion was filed that was decided on September 20th, 2011, denying the petition for certification and dismissing McGuire's appeal or Melanie's appeal. Melanie then went on to state post-conviction. She served as her own counsel, pro se, but eventually the Office of the Public Defender was appointed an attorney by the name of Lois Giulio.
They seem to have
Giulio.
Quite a bit of money. Why did they just all of a sudden, she needs a public defender? Did they spend all it on her?
I think they probably spent all the money. There, interestingly enough, too, there was no writ filed at the U.S. Supreme Court after her direct appeal. And that is either because, and I've seen that, you see that in a lot of life sentence cases. It's not worth filing at the U.S. Supreme Court. So, but I think probably her funds had certainly, any money that she may have had
run out.
And it probably had come pretty close to bankrupting the Caporeros as well.
Gotcha.
So that post-conviction was Superior Court of New Jersey Law Division Criminal, Middlesex County. The judge was Bradley J. Ferenc. The McGuire filed a verified petition for post-conviction relief. I'm going to paint this in very, very broad strokes because it really, when I read it, it was just a lot of nitpicky things that she believes if she eliminates this piece of evidence, then she's innocent and she should go free, or that eliminating this piece of evidence proves her innocence and she should go free. And that's really not how it works. And the fact that she thinks that's how it works is so cute. But basically, her petition focused on ineffective assistance of counsel for failure to call witnesses, failure to investigate, failure to retain experts, and failure to obtain records. She alleged there was a conflict of interest due to a reworked retainer agreement, failure to adequately investigate and counter the state's ballistic evidence, failure to investigate, which I've said before, consenting to live trial coverage, failure to have scientific analysis performed on two hairs identified as being of no evidentiary value, failure to move for a mistrial over jury contamination when the note from the dismissed juror was disclosed, and failure to present evidence of a mixture of DNA on Bill's sunglasses found in his car, which excluded Melanie, her family, and his sister. She also sought appointment of counsel from the Office of the Public Defender, which was ultimately granted, an evidentiary hearing, an order to the prison to produce her at hearings, a modification of her conviction and or a sentence reduction, and any other equitable relief. Motion for additional discovery was filed on March 1st, 2013 by McGuire, still acting pro se. A hearing was held on May 9th, 2013, and on May 21st, the motion for additional discovery was denied by order entered on that date. A motion to reconsider decision was filed on June 10th, 2014, also by McGuire, still acting pro se. A hearing on the post-conviction claims was held on that was denied, I think, without a hearing. A hearing on the post-conviction petition was held 2 days, August 15th, 2014, and September 25th, 2014. On October 2nd, 2014, the motion to reconsider was denied. Also on that date, the post-conviction relief was denied without an evidentiary hearing, and the court issued an opinion finding that McGuire's IAC claims failed to satisfy both prongs of Strickland, and she is unable to establish claims of ineffective assistance of counsel regarding the alleged ballistic evidence, failure to retain expert witnesses, failure to investigate, conflict of interest regarding the reworked retainer agreement, and failure to call witnesses. McGuire's cumulative error claims also failed because none of the asserted errors were found to have merit by the court. The court stated the plaintiff has failed to provide evidence of a prima facie case of ineffective assistance of counsel under Strickland slash Fritz. She has failed to demonstrate under the Strickland test that, one, counsel's representation fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, and two, there is a reasonable probability that, but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the result of the proceeding would have been different. Accordingly, petitioner's position for post-conviction relief is denied without an evidentiary hearing. This was appealed to the appellate division. McGuire was then represented by Michael A. Priorone and Joseph E. Carcora of the public defense, the public defender. Priorone was designated counsel probably for the appellate portion. And the state was again represented by Daniel Bornstein. Her notice of appeal was filed on December 30th, 2014. She filed her brief and basically raised two issues, or argued two issues, that the trial court erred in denying her motion to examine and test a computer and garbage bags held as evidence by the state, and that the trial court erred in denying defendant's petition for post-conviction relief without an evidentiary hearing on defendant's claims. So I'm not sure what those two hearings in August and September were. Maybe they were just arguments on.
Yeah, it's like, honestly, what they're. Yeah, it's very unclear.
I mean, it's in the record that the hearings were held and it was post-conviction hearing, but it may have just been argument. It may not have been witnesses appearing and testifying. And then the appellee brief was filed on February 8, 2016. And basically, I'm not going to go through the state's arguments because it's, they won. But she wanted to examine Bill's computer, and she, I will post their arguments in the comments and on Facebook to just get a little interactive participation going on with the listeners. Because it does give you kind of an idea of what she was complaining about. I'll post a link to her pro se petition as well. But at this point, I'm starting to stumble over my words.
Sure.
I don't want to make it worse. Oral argument was held on March 1st, 2017. A decision was rendered on August 7th, 2017. Defendant appeals from the October 2nd, 2014 order of the trial court denying her petition for post-conviction relief without granting an evidentiary hearing. We affirm. The court reasoned that because of the inherent difficulties in evaluating a defense counsel's tactical decisions from his or her perspective during trial, a court must indulge a strong presumption that counsel's conduct falls within the wide range of reasonable professional assistance. That is, the defendant must overcome the presumption that, Under the circumstances, the challenged action might be considered sound trial strategy. It is well established that in matters of trial strategy, we accord great deference to the decisions of counsel. It is axiomatic that one of the most difficult strategic decisions that any trial attorney must confront is determining which witnesses to call to the stand. A trial attorney must consider what testimony a witness can be expected to give, whether the witness's testimony will be subject to effective impeachment by prior inconsistent statements or other means, whether the witness is likely to contradict the testimony of other witnesses the attorney intends to present and thereby undermine their credibility, whether the trier of fact is likely to find the witnesses credible, and a variety of other tangible and intangible factors. Therefore, like other aspects of trial representation, a defense attorney's decision concerning which witnesses to call to the stand is an art, and a court's review of such decisions should be highly deferential. Judged by these standards, we agree that defendant failed to demonstrate good cause to compel the state to supply defendant with discovery, and failed to establish a prima facie case of ineffective assistance of counsel under Strickland to warrant an evidentiary hearing. Notice of petition for certification was sent on August 10, 2017 by the Public Defender's Office. On January 29, 2018, that petition was denied by the New Jersey Supreme Court.
I mean, I always try to make light of it, but like, the ineffective counsel, like that's like the standard. It's like every time you're convicted, it's ineffective counsel.
Yeah. And like I said, I'll post a link to her pro se petition. But it was a lot of nitpicky. Like, they didn't call this neighbor who claimed to have heard an argument on the night of April 28th or the early morning of April 29th. But in reality, the witness didn't say it was April 28th or 29th. And in fact, she wasn't sure when it was. Right. And she didn't understand what the people were saying. So she couldn't corroborate anything Melanie was claiming happened or said. And, you know, there were a couple of other things, like they should have called her mother, who would have said that she didn't smell bleach and she didn't see any heroic efforts of cleaning done in the Woodbridge townhouse to counter the state's reasonable belief that, first, Melanie, as a nurse, knows how to clean up blood. And second, as a nurse, Melanie knows how to protect the field and to prevent a lot of blood from ending up where it shouldn't be. Especially, and also her anatomical knowledge, she could have done right. The dismemberment.
Yeah.
You know, like her mother, but, you know, honey, your mother and your stepfather are suspects one and two
right.
in helping you in yeah. Atlantic City.
Yeah,
so, that's
probably dead, for sure.
And another thing I didn't mention is that on May 3rd, I didn't mention in my summary of the crime, on May 3rd, Melanie drove to Delaware, which would have taken her on, guess what? The Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. And so she probably dumped the suitcases at that time, which I didn't include. And I just missed that. I realized I missed it. So she claimed she was going Delaware furniture shopping, but all right. So we move on to federal habeas.
Hot spot of furniture of Delaware.
Well, no, Delaware has no state sales tax. And a lot of people on the Eastern Seaboard shop in Delaware because of no sales tax. They have extremely high property taxes, but they have no income and no sales tax. And so that is why people, especially big ticket items, you go to Delaware and you don't have what you see is what you get as far as the price. So if you're buying a vehicle or furniture or a pool, you know, well, not a pool, because you'd probably end up paying sales taxes when you install it in, you know, New Jersey or Pennsylvania. But yeah. And I think that sounds like they were in an area of New Jersey that's in that Delaware, Pennsylvania, tri-state corridor as opposed to New York. But I didn't look for Woodbridge on a map. All right. So McGuire served as pro se counsel for herself during her federal habeas claims. She was unable to get the federal court to appoint an attorney to her. However, she did have an attorney who did appear in 2021. The state was represented in those proceedings by Claudia Joy Dimitro. It was before the United States District Court for the District of New Jersey, Honorable Judge Michael A. Shipp, docket number 3:18-CV-03411-MAS, indicating Judge Shipp. She filed a petition for writ of habeas corpus on March 9, 2018. She basically repeated, for the most part, her allegations made in her state direct appeal and state post-conviction claims. So I'm just going to broad stroke it again. Juror taint deprived her of a fair trial. Ground two, prosecutorial misconduct violated petitioner's rights to a fair trial under the U.S. Constitution. Ground three, the trial court committed numerous evidentiary errors which denied petitioner a fair trial under the U.S. Constitution. Ground four, defense counsel at trial rendered constitutionally ineffective assistance under the U.S. Constitution. Ground five, defense counsel's representation was impeded at trial because of the retainer agreement with petitioner, in which counsel agreed to pay for any expert witnesses, since counsel now had a financial interest in saving money by not spending money for expert witnesses. This created a conflict of interest in counsel's representation and violated petitioner's right to effective assistance of counsel and conflict-free counsel. And unfortunately, I did not realize I had both of these contracts until it was way too late. So again, I'll post these in the comments so that people can look at them and see when they were entered and, you know, what their terms were for yourselves. On April 16, 2018, the judge entered an order directing the clerk to serve the petition and ordering the state and warden to answer within 45 days. On April 30th, 2018, McGuire filed a motion to amend her petition. On May 2nd, 2018, that motion to amend was granted. And on May 2nd, the amended petition went live. And it was filed mostly to correct a mistake McGuire made when she put the date for her post-conviction relief denial by the state court. She used the date of the direct appeal denial, which would have made her writ untimely. So as soon as she caught the error, she amended it to correct and put the correct date in so that her petition would be timely. An answer to the complaint was filed by the state and the warden on July 25th, 2018. McGuire filed a traverse, which is like basically a response that points out evidence or information that contradicts the answer or that supports her claims. We've seen that in the Kevin Cooper case as well. Exhibits to the answer to complaint were filed on September 14, 2018 by the respondents. And basically they attached the complete state court records, including transcripts from McGuire's trial. An application for assignment of counsel was filed on November 19, 2018 by McGuire. She amended that application on November 26, 2018. The state filed a response on December 3rd, 2018. A memorandum order was entered on March 13th, 2019, denying the amended application for assignment of counsel. McGuire sent a letter to the court on February 26, 2020, requesting a stay while she obtains counsel. And then on March 31st, 2021, the court entered an opinion, basically denying relief. Petitioner Melanie McGuire filed an amended petition for writ of habeas corpus. Respondents, the Attorney General of the State of New Jersey and Sarah Davis filed an answer. For the reasons stated herein, the amended petition is denied and a certificate of appealability shall not issue. Motion for stay denied. An order was entered on March 31st, 2021, denying the petition, the certificate of appealability will not issue, and denying the motion for stay and closing the matter, or ordering the clerk of court to close the matter. A notice of appeal was filed by McGuire on April 15, 2021. That was to the Third Circuit Court of Appeal, where the case was docketed on April 19, 2021, under docket number 21-1750. A notice of appearance was filed on April 20, 2021 by Mr. Farmer, who also appeared in the Federal District Court around the same time. He appeared in the Federal District Court on the 20th of April, and then he appeared in the Court of Appeals on the 6th of May. A motion for a certificate of appealability was filed on behalf of McGuire on May 10th, 2021. The Attorney General filed an entry of appearance, Attorney General Dimitro, on May 18th. As response to motion for certificate of appealability was filed on May 24th, 2021 by the state and the warden, and an order was entered on December 6th, 2021. Appellant's application for a certificate of appealability is denied as she has not made a substantial showing of the denial of a constitutional right. For substantially the reasons stated by the district court, appellant has not shown that reasonable jurists would find its assessment of her claims, including claims of ineffective assistance of counsel, prosecutorial misconduct, due process violations, and jury taint, debatable or wrong. And so that is the end. No Supreme Court writ was filed. That is the end of Melanie McGuire's legal challenges, absent, quote, new evidence. I'm surprised she hasn't alleged a Brady violation.
Yeah, I mean, she's alleged everything else. I mean, why not?
And the only thing I can think is that her only advocates are a couple of podcasters.
Yeah, she hasn't gotten much press. I mean, she doesn't have any of the innocence fraud folks on her side.
Yeah.
We don't have... Nobody's out there saying Terry Hobbs did it.
Right. Exactly. I think her family and her friends don't believe she did it, but I think for the most part, now it is interesting. There is the direct appeal podcast, but that's basically, what has become the trend is podcasters thinking that if you believe there's reasonable doubt that the jury was wrong to convict.
Right.
When you weren't in the courtroom for the trial, you didn't hear all the evidence. And in a lot of cases, you're not looking at the evidence. You're looking at your interpretation of that evidence. For example, the ballistics on the gun. Somebody went to the Taurus website and looked at the model, and on the website it said the bullet or the gun put the gun was 5 lands and grooves instead of 6 lands and grooves, which were consistent with the bullets from the crime. Well, the website is not unofficial resource. And as it turns out, that was one of the big claims about the ballistics in McGuire's appeals. But as it turns out, Taurus, in their manufacturing process, some of their guns are 5 lands and grooves, and some of their guns come out with 6 lands and grooves. And it just depends on the tools and dies used during the manufacturing process. But they're interchangeable and they're used. So it's, you know, they do produce guns with 6 lands and grooves. So that doesn't. And, you know, it's a shame, Melanie, you got rid of the gun. If the gun had nothing to do with Bill's murder, because you had nothing to do with Bill's murder.
Right. Why would you get rid of it?
Where was it? And exactly. at one point, she apparently sent the cops to her storage unit to look in a lockbox in her storage unit. And the only thing in there was batteries. There was no gun in there. And then she's like, oh, it must be lost. You know, you should, if you had nothing to do with the murder, you would have been able to produce that gun. You probably dropped that gun off the side of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge when you dumped the suitcases.
Yep. 100%.
And because it wasn't in one of the suitcases, it is at the bottom of the bay.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, why would you get rid of the gun if you didn't use it? There's no, yeah. I mean, yeah, you don't just throw away a gun. They're expensive. They're not easy to get, especially probably in like a New Jersey.
Yeah. And this is a gun that she tried.
Unless you used it to murder your husband.
This is a gun that she tried to hide by going and getting it in Pennsylvania with a Pennsylvania driver's license.
Right.
But it was funny, if I remember correctly, the gun store owner recognized her. Because it was kind of unusual for him to have a woman come in to his shop, apparently. But right. she bought the gun and ammunition 2 days before he disappears. And, you know, I got to say, she told Bradley Miller that she would take care of it. And she did. And she also saying he said she was the reason her sons grew up without a father. That's true, too. Not in the melodramatic way she was trying to portray it.
Right.
But realistically, it's her fault. And she's claiming innocence. And her theory is that he, first of all, she's trashed him so much over the years that it's disgusting.
Again, she could have just gotten a divorce.
Yeah.
She could have done a no-fault divorce and walked away.
She claims he was a degenerate gambler. She's tried to implicate him in drug use and drug abuse. And, you know, like she'll say, and every scam or scheme, it was all his idea. I mean, she's done insurance fraud. But it was Bill's idea. It's like you went along with it. In a clear and convincing show, I went a little bit more into the serious flaws in Melanie McGuire's character, which I didn't have reminders of because I didn't really watch any of the stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right. So there was a direct appeal podcast. Listen to it. But it's a bunch of podcasters that say, because we think there's reasonable doubt, because, well, we just don't see how she could do this or that or the other thing. You know, we don't see how she could have lifted the suitcase over the side of the bridge. She's a fucking nurse, honey. They teach you how to do that shit. They teach you how to lift patients 3 times your size. And, you know, they think because Melanie's a little diminutive woman that she's helpless. And like I said, they teach you in nursing school how to do that shit. How to manage patients.
Exactly.
And once she cut Bill into 3 pieces, he probably weighed about 65 pounds each. So, you know, it wasn't a trial. And the suitcases had wheels.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, she could definitely pick that up.
And she had, you know, a math, probably did sciences, So she probably, you know, knows about levers and fulcrums, and she figured it out. I mean, hell, I think she had a Nissan Pathfinder, and I saw one of the theories was that she could have basically maneuvered the suitcase right through the guardrail, not right, like over the guardrail from the bed of the Pathfinder. She wouldn't, if she didn't take it out and put it on the ground, you know, she didn't have to take it out and put it on the ground and lift it over. She just had to pull it from the bed and scooch it over a little bit.
Right.
So anyway, yeah, listen to that, but, you know, take it with a grain of salt. They're not, I don't think they're quite as bad as Bob Ruff, because they do admit that a lot of the circumstantial evidence, you just can't get away from it. The stink follows Melanie and just sticks to her. But they do, you know, they do say, well, she couldn't have lifted it, so she can't be guilty. You know, and they have somebody do it. They kind of, Kathleen Zellner-esque, they have somebody who does an experiment.
So is the direct appeal podcast, is that just to everybody's innocent?
I don't have enough. I did not really listen to it. I think probably so. These are two, quote, criminology professors, apparently. And, you know, criminology is going into more sympathy for the criminals than Law and Order and Justice.
They probably got their degree from the University of Phoenix online.
All right. So Melanie McGuire is incarcerated at the Edna Mann Correctional Facility in Clinton, New Jersey. As I said earlier in the program, her parole eligibility date is May 20th, 2073. Other famous inmates at Edna Mann were Diane Downs. She was there from 1987 after her recapture, after her escape, to 1994, and then she was sent to Valley State Prison in California, or she was sent to a prison in Washington and then to a prison in California. Amy Locaine, who was on Melrose Place, she was incarcerated for a vehicular homicide and assault by auto case in New Jersey. And Asada Shakur, who
is that? Tupac's?
Murdered.
Is that Tupac's mom?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure if that is Tupac's mother, or because, as I recall, Shakur is kind of like the move people. They take the name Africa. And this was another group that took the name Shakur. So I'm not entirely sure. I'm not going to say. I don't think it was, because I think she was, living in the free world, and this woman's in prison for murder of two New Jersey State troopers, as I recall. Don't quote me, because I'm not sure, but so she probably is not going to be free for a long time, more likely than not a month after Melanie McGuire. There was an investigation in that was launched by the DOJ in April 26th of 2018, investigating allegations of sexual abuse and assault against inmates by correctional officers and staff, and to determine whether the facility violates inmates' constitutional rights by not protecting them from the harm of staff sexual abuse. Investigation resulted in a report in April 2020 that did find staff sexual abuse at Edna Mann was severe and prevalent and had been going on for years. And in January of 2021, there was an incident where correctional officers forcibly removed inmates from their cells without justification, and in doing so, seriously injured two of those inmates. A consent decree between the New Jersey Department of Corrections was entered with DOJ on August 10th, 2021. The Department of Corrections will, among other things, implement policies and practices to ensure that prisoners are protected from harm due to sexual abuse through appropriate prisoner supervision, effective and confidential methods of reporting sexual abuse, and protections against retaliation for reporting sexual abuse. The proposed consent decree includes improved measures to ensure staff members are held accountable for misconduct. It also requires greater transparency through public meetings with stakeholders, including former Edna Mann prisoners, prisoner advocates, and family members of current Edna Mann prisoners. The proposed consent decree also appoints an independent monitor who will oversee and assess the state's compliance with the terms of the proposed consent decree. If the state of New Jersey closes Edna Mann, the consent decree applies to any facility that replaces a prison. Now, probably as a result of these investigations, there was an indictment in September 2022 against 14 correctional officers, although the specifics, I didn't find the specifics of that indictment. On November 1st, 2023, Governor Murphy did announce closure of Edna Mann's full minimum units. And there are also plans to construct a new female correctional facility that will eventually take the place of Edna Mann. It will be 100% closed, but that's going to happen in phases, and it's going to be a few years. Now, interestingly enough, Melanie McGuire has not, from anything I could tell, been a victim or subject in any of these allegations of abuse. I get the impression, unlike Pamela Smart and Carolyn Warmus, she kind of keeps her head down and does her time quietly and has managed not to piss anybody off.
Well, that's saying something right there.
Or she's connected enough through her stepfather to not be a target, which is wonderful. Glad, happy for her. On November 17th, 2023, a superseding indictment was issued with charges against a Mann sergeant, and additional counts against previously indicted officers, including conspiracy, official misconduct, tampering with public records, and aggravated assault. And I think what's happening is, when the allegations are coming out, then people are trying to cover them up and protect the people who are doing wrong, and or believing that the people who were doing wrong were unjustly accused, because you got to remember, sometimes you're dealing with manipulative people,
right? Probably
who
not the most
criminals.
Honest folks, exactly.
So
not well known for their honesty and transparency and truthfulness.
And then in December 4th, 2023, a second superseding indictment charged additional defendants and added additional counts. The additional defendants included 4 sergeants, 1 lieutenant, 1 major, and an associate administrator. They were indicted on second-degree conspiracy, official misconduct in the second degree, and some were also charged with tampering with public records in the third degree, aggravated assault in the second degree, and additional counts of official misconduct in the second degree. I'm not naming anybody. I found some names, but I'm not naming anybody. They deserve a right to a fair trial. And then if their case becomes a cause célèbre, I may look at it on a future episode once the direct appeals have made their way.
Interesting. Just situation.
Yeah. And ultimately, in addition to Bill and his sister and other family, niece, nephews, whomever, his friends and as well. The biggest victims for me are the 2 young boys who were 4 and 2.
That's got to be horrible just to live with that. I don't know how you emotionally ever get past that.
Yeah.
especially how brutal it was.
Their names have been withheld by media and legal documents, and but they are now adults. After their removal from their mother's custody in 2005, they were sent to live with Bill's sister, Cindy, and she was eventually granted custody of both boys. Reportedly, they were both diagnosed with autism at the ages of 5 and 7. Now, it's interesting, after she murdered Bill, before she was arrested, Melanie moved to a house in Brick, New Jersey, for the services available to her older son, who she believed was autistic but hadn't gotten a diagnosis for yet. So apparently both children had some level of autism. I don't know what that entailed or how, you know, whether it was, whether they're highly functional or limited functioning, or what their outlook or prognosis were. But that is Melanie McGuire.
Well, that's terrible.
Yes, it was terrible. And yes, I wish she had just divorced him.
I mean, that's where I go back to. Like, you could have just gotten a no-fault divorce and split everything halfway and, like, not even had an attorney and just said, hey, we'll split everything and move on versus you're going to spend your whole life in prison for no reason.
And, of course, she claims that she couldn't do that because he threatened to leave and take her boys if she divorced him.
Oh, yeah, she's not going to have her boys when she's in prison.
But it's like, well, that's what you ended up with.
Through. Exactly.
So, gee, you know, and in reality, I don't know. It's very difficult. I don't think Bill's friends believe that. And most of Bill's friends don't believe a word she said about any of it. They don't believe what she says happened. What the theory of what happened is that he was asleep on the couch. She got a pillow and she shot him in the head. And then she shot him in the torso. And then she moved his body to the bathroom, cut it up, put him in the suitcases, used what she had, which was garbage bags and the medical, you know, medical practice towel.
Right.
Got her parents to watch the kids and cleaned up. And, you know, that's, and I think a lot of people don't realize the state did not have to prove that the murder and dismemberment happened in the Woodbridge townhouse. They didn't have to prove where it happened. And she had a month, over a month, to cover her tracks, which she tried to do. She left the car in Atlantic City. When she was kind of seen, the video is grainy. You can't really see clearly that it's her, but the vehicle that looks like her Pathfinder and all that, she says, oh, well, I did go, and I found the car at the, I took a cab, and I found the car, and so I moved it from the Tropicana to the, or from the Tropicana to the Flamingo. Because we used to do that to each other, and he used to do that to me. And, you know, when we fought, we did that to each other. Yeah, Melanie, your eyes are brown because you're full of bullshit. But any questions, any thoughts, anything?
No, I just think it's another one of those tragic cases that could have been really avoided. I mean, all these cases can really be avoided, but like, this is like the worst.
Yeah. But thankfully she was a little lazy and she thought she covered her tracks, but she left strong circumstantial evidence that basically nailed her.
Yeah.
So and this, the theory that it was a loan shark, and, you know, basically, so we're supposed to believe he left without his wallet, in his car with these three suitcases. And then somebody found him and shot him with a gun consistent with the one Melanie just bought 2 days before. And then cut him into pieces and dumped him off the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. No.
Yeah, so you guys have a special kind of imagination to believe that.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, first off, a little program note. I am going to be recording next Sunday a bonus episode. And Kyle, you're free to join us if you like. With my coworker, friend, and work daughter, Jordan Murphy. And I hope she doesn't mind me saying her whole name. If she does, we'll fix it. We are going to be talking about Selena Quintanilla Perez because she's a big Selena fan. And Michael and I used to do the Selena shows on March 30th, 31st. We're going to record on Sunday the 14th, which is 2 days before Selena's birthday. So she and I are going to have a little talk about Selena and the potential release from prison of her killer, Yolanda Saldivar.
Oh, is she up for parole?
She's eligible for release next year. But
there's no way she gets out. She'll die the second she leaves prison. I mean,
that's what we were about to say.
She'd be safer staying in prison.
There are going to be, because I have seen multiple Facebook memes with not only Latinas, but Black ladies and white ladies, and they're planning on waiting outside that prison to convince Yolanda that she's safer there than she would be in the free world.
Stay in prison.
And then I've also read that there's like an MS-13 contract on her head if she ever gets out. And we're going to kind of talk about the oxygen, Selena and Yolanda, the secrets between them, which is really kind of was kind of a letdown because, first of all, this supposed secret wasn't really that new. And second of all, given the sources of Yolanda Saldivar, I wouldn't believe her if her tongue came notarized.
No, exactly.
So I really don't believe anything the woman has to say, and her family don't believe them either because they try and say, well, she's not really guilty of murder. So that's going to be, we're going to record that next weekend. And like I said, you're welcome to join us if you'd like.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's be in touch. I'd love to. It's a big player, you know, being based in Texas, very Latina, very,
okay.
I mean, actually my wife was never a big fan of Selena, but I know a bunch of her friends were.
Well, we'll pick her up and bring her.
Yeah, she
with
talk
us
about it. Yeah,
to the
she
prison.
Could do a little,
I think she's
bitty bitty
in,
bop.
whatever prison. If we decide to go wait outside for Yolanda to come out and show her, you know, we got Latinas with chanclas that are going to be hitting her from left and right.
Oh, that's so funny that you say that. Yeah, sorry. My wife always laughs about the chancla when her grandmother would hit her with that when they were bad. It's a special kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know or you don't know.
There's a video on Facebook that it should be an Olympic sport. It shows a lady and the kids running and they're a good distance away, but she throws it and you can't see it hit because he's so far away or she's so far away, but you can tell from the little side hop that sucker hit.
Yeah. My wife's grandma could hit her with a chancla from 100 yards away. Isn't that right, honey?
Well, if Christina wants to join us, she's welcome as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
She will definitely love that.
So I'll get with you with exact times and like we're doing our firm
fun
crawfish boil on Saturday. So yeah.
And the Derby's coming up.
Yeah, the first Saturday in May. So yep. Although I haven't been watching it as much as I used to. I don't know what happened. I just ever since my heart attack, I cannot watch horse racing like I used to. I used to put it on Saturday and Sunday all day long. And now it's like every now and then I'll watch a few minutes and then I can't watch it anymore. I don't know what's going on with that. But enough of my odd mental breakdown. thank you for listening to Based in Fact, a true crime podcast with Lisa O'Brien and Kyle Evans. If you like the show and want to know more, you can subscribe to our YouTube channel, find us on Facebook, or follow me on Twitter at O'Brien L. Ann. Kyle and I will be return in 3 weeks for episode 6, State of Florida versus Dahlia DiPolito. On August 5th, 2009, the producers and camera crew for the Cops television show got more than they bargained for when they were invited to along to film the resolution of a 5-day murder for hire investigation, which started when a convenience store owner reported that his girlfriend was trying to hire someone to kill her husband. We'll talk about the evidence against DiPolito, her first trial and successful direct appeal, and her second, her retrial, including her attorney's attempt to have the charges dismissed using the presence of cops' cameras to undermine the evidence against their client. Until then, have a safe 2 weeks and stay safe.